Jeffrey, what's that in your coffee cup?
What do you think it is, Jen? It's Death Wish Coffee. It's the only coffee I drink. Death Wish is the world's strongest coffee, and the world's strongest salesperson needs the world's strongest coffee.
Jeffrey and I drink it, and diehards, you need to be drinking it too. It'll help you wake up and smell the order forms. They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee, so go get your first bag or first box of K-Cups of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
So what does an order form smell like? I had a purpose. I always add humor to my thing. My purpose would be I help large companies with their training budgets until there's none left.
Sounds like my divorce lawyer. I want to pay the parties until the party has any money left and then we'll settle.
Exactly.
Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls.
I'm tweeting that puppy.
Okay. This is Sell or Die, the only sales podcast on the planet that isn't afraid to say you're either selling or you're dying. Because there's no second place in sales. Win or go hungry. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Glackow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute. And today, we are going to help you sell like hell.
Oh, yeah.
We've got a great guest coming up. But first, we want to introduce you to the one, the only, our man behind the curtain, behind the glass wall.
Wait, it's a glass window.
What? You know, it's a metaphor here. It's okay. Our amazing producer, Mr. Doug Branson. Hey, Doug.
Hello, Jeffrey. Hello, Jennifer. I want to remind everyone they can subscribe to this podcast and share it with their friends on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you get your podcast. Just search Sell or Die and make sure to leave us a review. We always love getting feedback from the diehards out there.
Five stars or nothing.
That's
Doug
right.
Doug sounds amazing on the mic.
We're the Uber of podcasts. We want a five-star rating.
Except we don't rate you. You only rate us. And don't forget to join us for Motivation Mondays, our live sales meeting on Facebook.com/Jeffrey Gittimer. We put on the podcast feed as well. But if you join us live on Facebook, you get to see us, interact with us, engage with us, ask us questions, or just say hello.
Okie dokie. Let's get to the rest of the show. It's time to sell or die. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. The great Jack Canfield is the beloved originator of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Known as America's number one success coach, Jack has studied and reported on what makes successful people different. Founder and chairman of the Canfield Training Group, holds the Guinness Book of World Records for having 7 books simultaneously on the New York Times bestseller list. Goodness gracious, please welcome the great Jack Canfield.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it.
We're glad you're here.
Yeah. You know, I this is probably a throwaway line. I had 4 books one time on the Wall Street Journal bestseller.
That's impressive.
And then when I read your intro, it totally pissed me off.
I think it was Stephen King once had 6 books on the New York Times list, and that was because he had taken a book and released it in 6 different chapters one at a time.
Oh,
yeah. No, that's cheating.
Oh, man.
Same way, but I had to beat him legitimately, you know.
You did a hell of a job, I'll tell you that. And, you know, people will still talk about the stories in Chicken Soup. What do you think makes them do that? Is it the stories or how they relate to them? What do you think caused that?
I think it's how that makes them feel. And at some point in life, I mean, just literally 2 days ago, I was in Toronto and I was running a workshop and it was a co-speaker. It was one of those big, you know, 5 speaker things for a day of success focus. And she was from England and she was very depressed at one point because her best friend and then her 2 sisters had died within a couple of years of each other. Ooh. And it was a Chicken Soup for the Soul book that she was reading on a beach that took her out of her depression and allowed her to start feeling good again. And I don't know that she could remember any particular story, but she remembered that that book made a difference in her life. And I think that's why people remember it.
That book made a difference in my life. I remember reading it as a teenager. I freaking loved it.
Yeah. No, I hear that a lot. I see these people that are now in their 30s and 40s. I read your book when I was a teenager. Well, that makes me feel really old.
Sorry. Yeah,
I happen to have been 7 at the time. But here's the deal. You remember how it made you feel when you got to the end. It was like eating dessert in literature.
There you go.
You are the dessert of literature. It's true.
That should be on the back of one of the
books. Someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said I want to be a chocolate mousse. So that, I guess that worked out.
There you go.
Cool. Do you go to Paris?
I've been to Paris, yes.
That's where they
have the best chocolate mousse. I'm obsessed with chocolate mousse.
They ask on the menu if you want the heroin or the chocolate mousse, and everyone orders the chocolate mousse.
Oh, man.
So when you're doing your coaching programs now, what do people expect when they get there?
Well, I think people in general come to me because there's something they want that they don't have, something they haven't accomplished that they want to, some place where they feel stuck. And actually, we're working on a book right now with another author called Unstuck. And the idea is that people are where they are and they want to get to where they want to be. That's the subtitle of my book, The Success Principles, How to Get from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have never learned the principles or the strategies or the formula or the system for success. And so I've literally interviewed hundreds and hundreds of the most successful people on the planet, you know, from generals to movie stars to Olympic athletes. We just did a thing. I went to the, I didn't go to the Super Bowl, but I was in Atlanta for the last Super Bowl and I spoke to the NFL Players Association. And these are all people that have been super successful. And now they're, you know, the average career in the NFL is 3.3 years.
Yep.
So you get these guys that have all this great knowledge about how to be successful. And now they want to become speakers. So we were there basically teaching them how to become better speakers and trainers. And I think that that's what everyone wants. They want to achieve the happiness, the wealth, the abundance, the relationship fulfillment that they're not experiencing. So I think people come for all different reasons. They could be entrepreneurs. They could be coaches. They could be authors whose books haven't made the bestseller list yet. But whatever it is, they want more of something.
But they also want to see you, the person, because they know how successful you have become with your books. And they want to know, like, what's the magic bullet? What's the secret?
Sure.
And you might want to tell listeners that it ain't one thing. You don't like go to bed at 7 o'clock and then wake up and you're fine.
No. And I get asked a lot, like, you have 67 success principles in your book, and which is the most important one? And I say, well, let me ask you the following question. If you can only keep one organ in your body, which one would you keep?
Yeah.
It's like you have to have them all if it wants to work well. And so there is a model or a pattern of success that, you know, we've been able to tease out from studying all the successful people in the world. And it also doesn't happen overnight. You know, everyone thinks we're overnight successes. I mean, the first Chicken Soup for the Soul book took 2 years to write. It took a year and a half before we got a publisher. And then another 18 months before we made a bestseller list. And we were doing what we call the rule of five, which is 5 radio, TV, print interviews every day for over, you know, 16 months before we got number 15 on the Washington Post. But if you know what you're doing and you do it consistently and persistently long enough, then the principles always work.
What are some of the, I know you need them all, but what are some of the top principles
that you really like?
Well, I think there's a little tiny little system that you know, there's 67 principles in the book. There's about 12 of them that are critical. And that is, number one, you have to take 100% responsibility for your life. Most people are blamers, complainers, and whiners and excuse makers.
Yep.
And so number two, you have to get clear, what is your purpose? So my purpose is to inspire and empower people to live their highest vision in the context of love and joy. And so I inspire with stories like Chicken Soup. I empower with books like The Success Principles and my trainings and courses and coaching programs and so forth, so that people can live their highest vision, not the vision of someone else, in harmony with the highest good of all concern, meaning you're not screwing over people like we did on Wall Street when a few people trying to get rich brought the whole economy down around the world. So basically, if you know what your purpose is, you can align then your vision. That's the third step. What is your vision of what your life would look like if you were fully living your purpose? And then turn your vision into specific goals that are measurable. How much by when? Because until it becomes a goal, it's just a good intention. It's a wish. It's a hope. And then you have to have a plan. Most plans don't work out exactly like you want, but at least it gives you steps to take. If mm-hmm. you don't know what to do, then find people who've already done it and find out what they did and learn from them. And then you got to take action. And to accelerate that action, you need to have affirmations and visualization. That's what activates the subconscious mind to come up with solutions. And then after you've learned how to use those, you start taking action. You have to respond to feedback. Most people don't ask for feedback because they're afraid of what they're going to hear. They don't want to hear the negative side. And so they don't learn from their actions. And they get defensive if people give them feedback. And then finally, it's persevere, persevere, persevere. And I would add two other things. You need to have an accountability partner, a coach, or a mastermind group that's going to hold you accountable and can brainstorm with you. And you need to meditate. I think if you don't meditate, you're not learning from the highest aspect of your own connectedness to either your higher self, the angels, God, source energy, however you want to refer to that.
You know, you're in pretty good shape, Jen.
I know.
She's
I
here
do
nodding.
All those
she
things.
Does everything.
I do all those things.
I had a purpose. I always add humor to my thing. My purpose would be I help large companies with their training budgets until there's none left.
Sounds like my divorce lawyer. I won't pay parties
exactly.
until the party has any money left and then we'll settle.
Exactly.
Oh, man. So let's talk about affirmations and visualizations, because sure. a lot of people struggle with developing a practice for those. What do you think is the best way to create a consistent routine around them?
Well, I think the main thing is you have to schedule it into your schedule. You know, the things that people put on their to-do list or should list don't usually get done. But if it's in your schedule, like from, you know, 7 to 7:15 or 7 to 8 or whatever, I'm going to meditate. I teach something called the hour of power. It needs to be done in the morning. It's 20 minutes of meditation, 20 minutes of exercise, and 20 minutes of reading. If you do that every day, that's going to be 365 hours that are devoted to your growth and your, you know, progression and your consciousness and so forth. You're going to be healthier. You're going to be more relaxed. You're going to be more calm. You're going to be more peaceful. And you'll probably be more successful in all the things you do. So, but research shows when you're adding a new behavior, if you do it in the morning, you're more likely to get it done. If you wait until the evening to exercise, the day gets crowded out, you never do it, you're too tired, whatever. So that's a big piece. And then the other thing is to make it a habit. Research seems to show, latest research is 66 days without missing a day in a row to develop a new behavior. About 30 days to develop a new neural pathway in your brain for a thought, like if you want to replace a negative thought with a positive thought. So the actual affirmations itself, about 30 days will actually create new beliefs and all that, but about 66 days to keep practicing it. And so what I do in the morning is I get up, I go to the bathroom, I come back, I sit down, I have a little meditation chair I sit in, and I will meditate for about 20 minutes, and then I do my affirmations. I have about 21 affirmations, seven areas of my life, three affirmations for each one. And I will read the affirmation, close my eyes, visualize it as if it were already accomplished, and then I will reopen my eyes, read the next affirmation. After a while, I don't even need to open my eyes because I know them. You know, you do them for months. But the key is it's got to be consistent. And then I also review that in night before I go to bed. There's research that shows what you think about, talk about, visualize and all that, and watch on TV and listen to and so forth. You're going to play through the night about six times more than what you did during the day, unless it was traumatic, like you had an accident or you lost a client or something like that. And so it primes the subconscious to work on the solution to the thing you're affirming and visualizing.
Each of us has a morning routine. It differs a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mine is I wake up, I write, I read, I prepare. And that causes me to think and create.
Yes.
And Jen, what's yours?
I do affirmations, visualization, meditation. I try to work out, but sometimes it just involves walking the dogs. I read and I write.
I heard something really funny there. The guy said, I named my dog 6 miles. So I can tell everyone every day I walked 6 miles this morning.
Charlie, you're getting a new name, bud.
That's funny as hell. That is funny as hell. But, you know, if I have found that successful people have a morning routine.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, Robin Sharma wrote a really good book. I think it was called The 5 a.m. Club or something like that. And a lot of people now are doing this. And I was part of a book. I was supposed to co-author it, but I backed out. It was just too much bandwidth I didn't have at the time. But I wrote the foreword for it. It's coming out in June. It's called The Billion Dollar Secret. And this friend of mine, Raphael Bazier, interviewed 21 billionaires. It was really hard to get to, but he spent almost 5 years doing it. And once he noticed, every one of these people got up somewhere between 4:30 and 6 in the morning. Mm-hmm. They had morning routines. Most of them, they all exercised, even into their 80s. I think 85% of them meditated every day. And so that early morning rising and having those kind of disciplines is really powerful. And the other thing too, Jeffrey, is that most of the people I know, including myself, do schedule time for thinking. Most people don't think enough. I know John Maxwell talks about thinking and writing as two of his morning routines. And I just started thinking, putting about a half hour in the morning after my meditation. And I just was thinking the other day, what could I do to make $1 billion? I've never given myself that question before. My goal was 30 million at 6% interest. That gives me 1.8 million a year to live on, which I thought was fine. But when I was doing this billionaire book and reading all the stories and going like, well, why not at least think about it? And I started coming up with ideas, and it's really fun. So, I mean, we all know the questions you give your mind will work on and come up with solutions. But so ask bigger questions.
They come up with the solutions when you're least expecting them.
Right.
And you have to document them right away or you forget.
Right.
My friend, like, I'll remember that in the morning. Like, that's the biggest bullshit line I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. No, I always have my cell phone near me and I can go to, record. Yeah. But my friend Mark Victor Hansen, always said, as soon as you think it, ink it. And I think it's
a good
model. Yeah.
How's his health?
He's doing well, from what I hear.
So, tell us about your video about making a decision.
Well, basically, I talk about the fact that indecision it costs you. And most people take way too much time to make a decision. Most people hesitate, procrastinate for fear of making the wrong decision. They're afraid they're going to lose, make the bad decision. They'll be humiliated. They'll lose money. They'll possibly even lose their life if you make the wrong decision. People do that. And so, I think that the main thing you've got to do is find a way, like a system for decision making. I met a guy recently. He's got the fifth highest IQ ever recorded in the history of the world, a guy named Walter O'Brien. I don't know if you've heard of him. He has a TV show called Scorpion, and he only hires people with an IQ of 165 or above. And
I'm out.
Exactly. And he's got a company called The Concierge. He told me, I just made a deal yesterday. It was $85 million. I mean, he plays at that level. And
wow.
He can solve any problem. At 13, I'm going to get to your question with decision making in a second. But at 13, he hacked into the NASA and downloaded the schematics for the space shuttle. 2 days later, two black helicopters landed on his property. Guys jumped out in black suits with Uzis, and they thought he was a terrorist. Turns out he's a 13-year-old kid who was just having fun. They said, you can either go to jail or you can come work for NASA. He went, I think I'll work for NASA. So by the time he was 16, he had a company with 600 employees. He's brainiac to the max. And what he taught me is that you have to have systems for things. And so most people don't have a system for making a decision. Some people will take 20 minutes to decide what to have for lunch. Come back later. I need to think about it. They'll ask you what you're going to have, on and on and on. And so I think the key thing, there's a wonderful book written called The 10-Second Rule. And one of the ideas is, make decisions quickly. We found the billionaires that were interviewed in this book that I mentioned all made decisions quickly, and then they were slow to change if they ever changed at all, and they got into action quickly. And you can get feedback on the action, and that's better than just waiting around trying to wait for, I always say some people are waiting for 12 doves to fly over the house in a sign of a cross, and then they know it's the right time to do something.
Right, exactly.
That will take forever. I've never seen that happen.
I wanted to throw in there for our diehards that are listening. Think about the last time you bought a computer, a new computer. Were you scared to buy it? Were you afraid that the minute you bought it, it was going to be obsolete? You know, that's the crap that people exercise on a regular basis because it's a couple of grand and they don't want to, you know, well, what happens if I buy it next week and they come out with an update? Dude, tough shit. Just buy it.
Exactly. And, exactly. Just do it. I mean, my mentor was a man named W. Clement Stone, who you probably heard of. He was worth $6 million when I worked for him. He'd be a billionaire by today's inflationary standards. And he actually gave out these buttons and said, do it now. And, you know, we now see Nike uses that, you know, just do it now kind of thing. And he was just saying, you know, make a decision and start. You'll learn more from starting than you will by sitting around and trying to figure it out forever. That's not to say you shouldn't gather data. You shouldn't, you know, do some research and all of that kind of stuff. But I know some people that literally will take a year and a half to decide to do something, like where to go for a vacation, whatever, or they just never decide. And what we find, because I've worked with people, I used to be a psychotherapist, was when people don't decide, it's the fear of screwing up and they're afraid that they're going to be, you know, a million things. So they procrastinate waiting for themselves to be less confused. And the fact is, it never happens. So you just have to take your guess at some point. I work with CEOs who will sometimes say, we're not going to discuss this for 15 minutes. At the end of 15 minutes, we're going to make a decision. They say, well, why can't we talk about it over dinner? Because we're going to decide in 15 minutes. That's why they're the CEO. They move
right. Right.
They get on
right.
with it.
I'm Jeremy Fulkerson, and I host the Hidden Stories podcast on the Sell or Die Network. In our podcast, we share stories of seemingly everyday people that are your neighbors, community leaders, entrepreneurs, survivors, mothers, fathers, and friends. But we don't share the regular dinner talk conversations. I believe we all want to be better spouses, friends, parents, and leaders. My hope is by hearing these hidden stories, it will give you the courage to be a better you. Find me on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. There are links in the show notes to subscribe.
I have a little gimmick that I use about that I talk about sales balls, and I tell people if you ever get a golf ball with a company's logo on it, you hit it in the woods because it's a crappy ball. So I decided I never wanted my golf ball to be hit in the woods. So I put an idea, I put this slogan, sales ideas with balls. And I package them in pairs. And then I'll chuck a couple of things out into the audience and people are like fighting over them. But the essence of it is, can you transfer that message to where they're willing to make the decision? That's the real issue.
Do you have a specific process for or system for actually making the decision?
Yeah, I do. I think the first thing you have to do is decide what are your values? Most people are not clear about what their values are. They're very situational about things instead of clarifying. So I have a clear set of values. My first value is love. My second value is learning and growing. My third value is fun and joy, you know, so I can go down my values. And if what I'm about to decide is not aligned with those values, not our values, integrity, for example. So when I got, you know, one of the major decisions I had to make was whether or not to keep working for a training company or leave and start my own training. And when I found out that the trainer who ran this whole company was really off target in terms of their integrity in a lot of areas, it was a no-brainer decision for me. I literally decided on a Saturday night and Sunday morning I moved out. And when they came to work on Monday, I was gone. And it was that fast. Because I knew I couldn't continue to do this. When I got divorced, it was the same situation. It started to get to be a very gray situation. I wasn't having fun. I was not experiencing love. So my two highest values, or two of my three highest values, were being, you know, not working. So if you're clear about your values, the second thing is I do think you have to schedule time, like a block of time, to actually think about it and to think about, like, what are the benefits of doing it, this one? What's the benefits of that? What's the cost of not doing this and the cost of not doing that? And look at what are the payoffs. You know, like, if you're thinking about moving, it may be very exciting to move to Miami, but what are the rents down there? Do you know anybody? Have you checked out the coworkers you're going to work with? What's the market like, et cetera? So there is research that one needs to do. But once you've done all the research, I'm a big believer in trusting your gut. So your gut needs to be informed by your mind. That's why you do the research. And then I'll imagine making one decision and I'll notice how I feel. Does my body contract or does my body expand? Do I feel a sense of relief and happiness and joy, or do I feel a sense of burden? And so I trust my body a lot. And there are techniques for tuning into your body. For example, you can do something called the quick coherence technique, which is taught by the Institute for Heart Math, where you simply close your eyes and you slow your breathing down to a count of six in and six out. And you imagine breathing in through your heart, which activates your heart. And then you imagine someone or something, I've got my eyes closed now because I'm doing it with you, is you imagine someone or something that you really appreciate. I usually imagine my wife, or you could imagine your favorite guitar or your dog or whatever. And when you get into that state of appreciation, that's where you're all aligned. Your head, your spirit, your heart, and your gut are aligned. And then you can ask yourself, what is the best decision? And usually you'll get a very clear answer. So that's basically how I do it.
So we deal with salespeople all the time. Is there a way that they can make the decision as to, is this person the right fit for me? Or should I continue to follow up even though he's not responsive to me? What do I do in those kind of situations?
Well, I would do something like I would close my eyes. I would get into a state like I just talked about, whether you meditate or deep breathe or however you do it. And then I would close my eyes and I would bring that person into my space. I would imagine them sitting in front of me. And I would have an honest conversation and allow my subconscious or my higher conscious mind to answer back. So if I were imagining you, Jeffrey, I would say, you know, Jeffrey, you know, I've called you back six times now. You've only answered me once. Is this, should I be experiencing this as a no? Or is this a situation where I need to persevere? And then what happens is I'll get an answer. It's the strangest thing. This image of you will answer me back. And then I can ask myself, can I trust this answer? Now, another thing I teach is called somatic decision making. It's called the sway test, where you learn what does your body say when it's no, and what does it say when it's yes. So I teach this to like 1,000 people at a time. Everyone stand up. They say, close your eyes and ask your body what a yes answer or what it will be. And your body will either sway forward or will sway backwards. And just wait for an answer. And 98% of the people will actually sway forward. I can watch the whole group just start to do that. And then some people go backwards. That's how it works for them. Then I'll say, what is a no answer? Just ask your body, what's a no answer? And it'll go backwards. Now, test it. Make sure it's calibrated correctly. What is my name, Jack? You only ask yes or no questions. If it goes forward when it's supposed to be a yes, and you have to just wait and see what happens. Then you know, how, am I 49 years old or am I 74? Do I live at this place with my mother's name, Ellen, whatever. Once you can trust the answer, now you can ask things like, should I pursue this? Should I not do that? Now, it sounds a little woo-woo, but it actually works for me very, very well. There's nothing against asking for advice. There's nothing against researching. There's nothing against, you know, asking other people, if you work with this guy, what do you think, et cetera. But at some point, you have to decide, and I trust that.
We should do the sway test to see if we should get a third dog.
Yeah, I know.
His body just went backwards.
Yeah. I went forwards. I'm not sure about that.
I almost fell off my chair.
All right, so
we stay together without a dog. Never mind.
So far, we're fine with two.
Oh man!
Someone asked Paula Poundstone, "How did you end up with 17 cats?" She said, well, when I had 16, I bought one more.
Exactly.
That's funny. So you recently tweeted out your program for vision boards.
Yes.
Should people in sales have a vision board? And what should that look like?
I think everyone should have a vision board, because what we know is that our subconscious mind is programmed by images, and external images and internal images. That's why visualization is so powerful. But your vision board can be something that stimulates you when you're not with your eyes closed, and also remind you to close your eyes. So a vision board, for those who don't know, is simply a collection of images and words. It can be put on a poster board, your refrigerator. I have one on the back of my door, literally from floor to ceiling. So it's on the back of my office door. So when I'm leaving my office, I stop for a minute and I look at it. It's there in front of my face every day. And what you should have on it, or let me just say one story about why I think it's so powerful. Everything I put on my vision board about 5 years ago has come true. I had a picture of me with Oprah. I photoshopped a picture with me with Montel Williams, which I photoshopped. A picture of me with Larry King, which I photoshopped. I ended up on all those shows. I had a picture of me and my wife in three different vacation spots around the world. We ended up being there. I had put eight of those $1 million bills that salespeople and motivational speakers give out. And I put eight of those on my door, and I made $8 million that year. So I know that it works. My favorite story is I was running a workshop. I always do 10 free workshops workshops for the local community, like for the Boys Clubs, Girl Scouts, that kind of thing. I did one for the community college, and a woman named Cynthia Dodona took the training, and she went home and made a vision board, and she put on her vision board all these pictures of Greece, like, you know, Santorini, and all these beautiful images of white buildings and blue seas. And then down at the bottom, she had love, couple, relationship, and so forth. She was single. Within 6 months, when she did not have a boyfriend, she did not know anybody, she'd never been to Greece. Within 6 months, she met her love, and within a year, they were married. And I have a picture I show in my talks of them sitting on one of those white buildings with the blue background, her in a wedding dress, him in a
cool.
Tuxedo.
That's cool.
Yeah, totally cool.
So it's totally
Let me let Kat out of the bag here. Jennifer has a vision board. My 10-year-old daughter, Gabrielle, has a vision board. I don't have one, but I put Post-it notes on my bathroom mirror, so I'm... Yeah. When I get out of the shower, I visualize what I need to be doing at that moment in time. But the vision board works, and it's exciting to do.
Sure.
Yeah, I put a new car. I put a Tesla on my vision board, and I now have a Tesla. So
very cool.
I think
very
it's cool. Working.
I had an affirmation that I made up. This is the power of affirmations, aligning with vision boards. I was doing a seminar for a company, I think it was GE, and I'd do 3 seminars a day for like 5 days in a row. So I was like, you know, I needed more stuff. So I made up an affirmation, made a slide of a house in Hawaii. And I said, I'm so happy and grateful to now be watching the sunset of Kaanapali Bay in my beach house in Hawaii. And did not even want that, just made it up for a slide. And about a year and a half later, one of my partners had built a house in Hawaii. It was a $12 million house. They were building it for spec to sell it. And then they fell in love with it and couldn't sell it. So now they wanted to live in it. But the mortgage was $25,000 a month and they couldn't afford it. So they wanted to bring in a third investor. And they asked me if I'd be an investor. And I said, sure. So I put $3 million into the house. I'm sitting on the balcony of this house one night and I'm watching the sunset and they go, oh my God, this really worked. And I didn't even intend it. I'm sitting here on the Pali Bay, you know?
That's so classic.
So this stuff works, but you got to work it. That's the key. A lot of people know these things. They've read them. They have what I call shelf esteem. They have all these notes on their shelf, but they don't have what they want.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of doing it. And what I
that's a that. Classic word. Shelf
yeah.
Esteem.
I love that.
I think what salespeople should have on their vision boards, the amount of money they want to make per year, their retirement, you know, like what's your net worth when you retire, how many clients you want to have, you know, pictures of the objects you want to own, like your Tesla, your house, the boat, the car, the jewelry, the, you know, Armani suits, whatever it might be, vacations. Like if you like to scuba dive, put a scuba diver up there. It's phenomenal how it works. I mean, everyone I know in this world that does it achieves amazing things. We're having vision board parties for kids now, and the kids are putting things on there, you know, and all of a sudden, a year or two later, they have them. You know, it's powerful.
I have asked salespeople for years, how much money do you think it'll take to retire? And I'll wait for an answer, and I'll say, well, how much of that do you have right now? And it's unbelievable the gap that exists between what people think they need and what they're willing to do to get it.
Right. Well, most people are not, first of all, most people are financially literate. They're literate. They don't know, they've never studied money. You have to study the things you want to be successful at. And they've never made the decision to actually be wealthy. They've never made the decision to be comfortable when they retire. And like a lot of people, if you ask them how much they'll need when they retire, they can't even answer you. And if they do, like you said, they're way far away from it. That means, John DeMartini, who's one of my friends, teaches that you should save 50% of your income. In other words, you pay your taxes, and then the 50% of what's left over, you save, and you invest. And for a lot of people, that's difficult. John Marks Templeton, who was one of the richest guys that ever lived, he started saving 50% of his income, and he became a billionaire. And that's what John DeMartini was inspired by. And what he did, he went to his company, and he said, we're not making enough money. We need to make more money. Now, here's what's going to happen. I need to make this much. I'm going to take it out. If there's not enough left for your salaries, I'm not paying you. So you guys have to figure out how we're going to make more money. And they did. And he puts 50% of his money, and he's now worth, hundreds of millions of dollars. But it's that willingness to be disciplined and sacrifice in the short term for the long term. Most people won't do that. I mean, I know when I was in my 20s, I wanted to buy the car now, the art now, the cool TV now, all that stuff. And the reality is, it's much better if you do your life like this, where you don't spend it now and have a lot later. Not that you shouldn't spend some, but most people are very unplanned. They don't plan well.
Yeah. Come over to our place. You can see my impetuous purchase art collection.
Well, I have some of that now, but I can afford it now.
Right. Yeah. For sure.
So can you give any other advice to a salesperson who's listening to you and go, wow, it's Jack friggin' Canfield. I'm looking for that silver bullet. The Lone Ranger has it, but you may have something that might get them to the Lone Ranger.
Well, I think most people don't. I think most people have limiting beliefs that they don't know they have. So I think the silver bullet that I've been focusing on recently is that if you're stuck and you're not producing what you want, because we all have the capacity to use our imagination and our talents and our abilities to create anything we want. And most people find themselves stuck. So what I've discovered is that between the ages of 3 and 8, almost every one of us made a number of decisions that we made and then forgot we made. So like, it's not okay to be sexy. It's not okay to ask for what you want. It's not okay to want money. Money's evil. You know, all the kind of things that, you know, you've heard a million times. But you don't know you made it. And so what happens is you're living your life. I like to describe it as if you were getting on a plane and you're sitting down in first class and you notice the pilot, you know, the pilot's 6 years old. How would you feel? Most people would feel pretty nervous.
Uh-huh.
Most people are walking around with a 6 to 8 year old running their life because these are decisions you made that are still affecting you. So there are techniques now for surfacing those and then replacing them with a positive alternative. Now, affirmations are one way to do that over time. But you can only affirm the opposite of something negative if you know what the negative is. And for most people that I work with, they're not in touch with that decision. I'll give you one example. Working with a client who is a world-class athlete, and she should have been winning Olympic medals, and she wasn't. And whenever she would get up to those high levels, she would just not get there, and yet she performed better in practice. So when we did this process with her, she went back to where she was about 10 years old, 8, 9, 10. And her mother would hide her medals and her trophies and her ribbons when she would come back having won these meets. And she finally asked her mother, she said, "Mom, why do you hide my medals?" And she said, "Because your little brother is not as talented as you and it makes him feel bad."
Ooh.
So she decided at the young age that when I win, it makes people I love feel bad. So unconsciously, she stops herself from winning. Now, once she decided that, became aware of it, decided that was just then, that was her mother, and it's not true anymore, she went on and won a lot of medals. So it's that kind of thing that's stopping a lot of people. Fear of rejection because, you know, they don't want to look greedy. They don't want to look pushy. I mean, that was a big issue for me. You know, I had to overcome in my life to become a good salesperson was the fear of looking like I was being pushy because I'm Mr. Love and Light and all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't want to be seen that way. And what I realized is I was depriving people of the opportunity of the value of what I had to give by being too nice and milquetoast and all that kind of stuff and not asking for the clothes and all those things. So I think that's a big issue for people. I think also there are a lot of people that have this self-image that I'm not blank enough. Everyone can fill in a blank. I'm not blank enough. I'm not old enough, positioned well enough, educated enough. My mentor, W. Clement Stone, used to train salespeople this way. He would take a salesperson, and most of his salespeople were not even college graduates, and they were afraid to like try to sell a bank president because they were uneducated. And he would walk through the door, and he'd say, "Well, I'm going to go sell this bank president. Watch how I do it." And he would do the sale. Then he'd take him out to coffee and he'd say, "Now, what'd you notice what I did?" And he'd tell him what he saw. And he said, "Well, you lift out two things. This is important, these two things. So now we're going to go again to a different person, watch for those two things." So they'd do that 2 or 3 times. A 4th time, they'd be walking into the office and he'd just turn to the guy and say, "This one's yours." And there'd be no prep, just "This one's yours." And so the guy was freaking out, but he did it. And if he didn't do it right, Stone would take him out and say, "Well, you missed one thing. Here's the thing you missed. I'm going to do it one more time and show you. Now it's your turn again." By the end of the day, the guy was a competent salesperson because he'd overcome his fear of people that he thought he couldn't sell to. But most people will never call on certain clients because they're afraid of rejection or big companies or do cold calls or whatever the fears are. But those are all overcomable if you can work on the limiting beliefs. And then as Stone proved, you know, action will overcome fear. And so sometimes you just have to feel the fear and do it anyway if you don't have access to people that can help you get rid of the limiting beliefs.
And how do you think someone could best identify those limiting beliefs? Because I don't think, I mean, most people don't walk around saying, well, I have this limiting belief and it's stopping me from making more sales.
I think you have to listen to what your parents told you when you were growing up. Like some people will say to me, I'm not very funny. That's because their parents said, wipe that silly smile off your face 500 times.
Yeah, don't be a wise ass to me, young man, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
Now, there's a number of things you can do. I think that's where meditation becomes very valuable, because when you're sitting just in an observer position, you can watch those thoughts go by and you begin to realize they're just thoughts, like the scroll on the bottom of CNN or Fox News. However, I think the most powerful way is that when you find yourself feeling like you should do something, but you're not doing it, is then to close your eyes and ask yourself the following question. What is it that I want that I'm not getting? And then to say, when I think about this thing I want that I'm not getting, what do I feel? Do I feel angry, hopeless, resigned, fearful, anxious, whatever it might be? And then simply scan your body from your head to your toe and notice where in your body do you feel the greatest amount of tension, pain, or numbness? Because pain is what's really going on. Tension is the trying to pull that pain down. Numbness is when you've succeeded in numbing it out so you don't feel it. Then what you do is say, is there a feeling inside of that? Usually it's fear, it's embarrassment, it's, you know, shame, whatever. Now, ride that back to the earliest time you can remember feeling that. And everyone ends up between 3 and 8 years old. You know, I had a issue where I was like overwhelmed. My office was so cluttered. I had 4,000 unanswered emails. I had books piled up that people wanted me to write forwards for and wasn't doing it. And when I did that process, I ended up under my grandmother's porch with my dog they were about to euthanize. I was trying to save my dog. And they finally found me. And they took it. He had bitten a neighbor. And they took it and they killed my dog. And I made a decision at that point that I would never be in a situation again where I couldn't help the helpless. And so I spent all of my years working in inner city schools, working in impoverished situations, working with the Job Corps, working with the poor, doing civil rights work with African Americans, et cetera, and not taking fully care of myself. And so what happens is, after I did that session and realized it's okay to only work with the people I want to work with and just trust my intuition, I threw away 12 garbage bags full of unanswered letters, unanswered emails, books and manuscripts I was never going to read, etc. And now I have a very abundant life because I don't have that running me anymore.
Yeah.
What is it that I want? Tell me that question again. What is it that I want that I'm not getting?
Yeah, what is it I want I'm not getting? And then what do I feel when I think about that? So that's the second question. What's my emotional reaction to the fact that I can't have it or not having it? And then you ask yourself, you have to sit with your eyes closed and scan your body from head to foot and notice where in your body you feel the most pain, tension, or numbness. So for me, it was a 2x4 going right across my back. Another time it was a kind of a hand pressing on my head. Another time it's been a band around my stomach. And then you say, you really have to focus on it, because most people don't. The reason you're not aware of it, you don't want to feel it. Most people don't want to feel pain. They don't want to feel tension. And then, is there a feeling inside of that that's being, you know, held in that? And then can you ride that sensation and that feeling back to the earliest time you felt it? Where were you? What was happening? What decision did you make as a result of it? And then what's a new decision you could make? And then give yourself permission to have that decision and come back into the present.
And when someone says, what do I want more of that I don't have right now? If they say money, you have to answer, what are you going to do with it? And that's the real answer?
Well, you know, money, a lot of people teach that. What do you want from the money? What would the money give you is a question I always ask. Mm-hmm. It would allow me to buy a house. It would allow me to have, you know, freedom. It would allow me to, you know, get out of debt. It would allow me to, you know, attract better women or love rich men, whatever it is. But the point is, sometimes money by itself is very comforting to know I have millions of dollars in the bank. You know, now I also know that if it all went away, crash happens, you know, we have to leave America like the Jews left Germany in World War II. I know that I have the skills inside of me to recreate wealth. And so that, I think that's the bigger issue, is to know that my happiness is not dependent on that. But yeah, visualizing a box full of money is not as valuable as visualizing your life that you would have if you had that money. So when I first set my first $100,000 goal when I was making $8,000 a year, I visualized I visualized the check for that amount. I visualized the bank balance, but I also visualized the house I would live in, the car I would drive, the vacations I would take, the clothes I would buy, all of that. Absolutely.
Cool. Do you listen to Earl Nightingale ever?
I did a long time ago when I first was introduced to him. Absolutely. What a voice.
You have the same demeanor of wisdom.
Oh, thank you. Thank
you. You're welcome.
This has been
incredible.
Most people that are really wise have gray hair. I think I've established that.
Yeah. I got so wise that it fell out.
Well, you grew through the top of it. You were so smart.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's one of my friends said, I don't have to eat anymore. I now have a solar panel on top of my head.
Oh, man.
So listen, this is a great interview.
Yeah. I'm going to take a picture for Instagram.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Are you smiling?
Awesome. Got it.
Okay, cool. The challenge that anybody has as you listen to this interview is to re-listen to it and then listen to it one more time, writing down some of the most salient things that affect you as a person, that affect you as a listener. Because Jack Canfield is not a smart guy. He's an exceptionally smart guy. And he can help you by making you think about yourself. And that's the whole key is you've stimulated me and Jen to a point where we're going to be talking about you all damn night.
And I hope so. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, but it's a pleasure.
No, yeah, this has been amazing.
Make an offer to your listeners, too. If they go to my website, they can download a free 10-day course. It comes in the form of, it'll come to your computer, your iPad or your iPhone or your cell phone, Samsung, Mac, whatever you got. And it's called the 10-day success transformation. And what happens is 10 days, everything we talked about in this interview, you'll get to actually do it during the day. And there's 10 principles we talked about in the beginning when you asked me, you know, what for is. And so you just go to jackcanfield.com, jackcanfield.com/transformation. And you can download that as my free gift to you so that it becomes something you actually Velcro into your system rather than just have come in one ear and go out the other.
Wow, that's amazing.
We will put
and
it
generous.
In the show notes.
Yes, for sure. Thank you.
Hopefully 100,000 people or so will download it. I can't guarantee you what they're willing to do with it because they watch some bullshit show on television Thursday night at 9 o'clock. But I think in the final analysis, you've given them gold. All they have to do now is put it in a bag.
Well, you know Les Brown. Les Brown's one of my good friends. My favorite line of Les Brown was Mark and I were teaching with Les at a church. And he said, you're watching Mark, Jack, and I go from local obscurity to national obscurity right in front of your eyes. Great line. But what Les did once, he came to a National Speakers Association conference and he showed a check that he had just gotten. I think it was for like $100,000 or $300,000. And it was for a PBS special he'd done where he had they were giving away one of his products in the people, but they had to buy the products from Les. And I said, Les, that's amazing. And he said, yeah, I'm going to give a talk on it here. I'm going to tell everyone how to do it. I say, doesn't that threaten you, all that competition? He said, no, most people will never do it. He said, exactly. The difference between the people that are successful and the people that aren't is they take action. And so a little bit of action on anything we talked about today is better than no action on anything. So
agreed.
So,
I can tell you this. You've inspired a lot of people. And we're very grateful for your participation today. You have made a legacy mark on millions of people around the world and in your own town. Another fantastic episode of Sell or Die is now in the books.
Let's let the listener be the judge of that.
You can be. Subscribe, rate, and review our show today. In fact, right now.
Or if that sounds too complicated, tell a friend.
Tell both your friends.
Because if you're not selling,
you're dying.
We're leaving.
Au revoir.
Shalom. Sell or Die Hards. If you love the show, make sure you've subscribed.
And if you've subscribed, make sure you rate us on iTunes or give us a star on Overcast.
And if you've done all of that, tell a friend about the best sales podcast on the planet. Or better yet, tell both your friends.
And if you've done all of that, well, You're a true sell or diehard, and we thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.